Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 17th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, A Political Roadmap Full of Roadblocks, Detours, and Walls. Session 3 of Roadmaps and Detours, Stories and Images from 5 Years in the Holy Land, presented by Michael and Susan Thomas, number THM 2003-03. Let's listen in.
Today what we're going to do is give you something of the context in which we lived in Jerusalem, and also ask you to reflect on your own context. Because it's what you see when you look out your window in the morning that often shapes how we look at the world. If you wake up at, say, 5:30 in Holden on a July summer day, and you look out your window or stand on your porch and see this beautiful image of God's created world, you might have a different sense of what life is like, what its possibilities are, than if you look out on your window. This is from our bedroom window in Jerusalem, looking out at the old city and looking at the mosque, the minarets that call faithful Muslims to prayer, looking at the Dome of the Rock. The Church of the Redeemer, by the way, is almost on the far right. It's the pointed one with the pointed tower, built in the late 19th century. And then, because this is always fun, people don't realize that it snows in Jerusalem. And when it does snow, your world is transformed, at least for a day, sometimes 2 days. This is from this past February when we had about 14 inches of snow on the ground. But if you look out your window from Jenin, which is the city in the far north of the West Bank, I shouldn't really say far north, there is no far north in the West Bank, but at the very top of the North Bank, of the West Bank, so to speak, if you are children and you've just gone through, in March 2002, an experience that has to traumatize any person, whether you're a child or an old person. This is at the refugee camp. There had been an attempt by the Israelis after these disastrous, tragic suicide bombings in February and March of 2002. The Israelis decided that the only way that they could really crack down was to essentially reinvade the West Bank that they already largely control. Though there is also was the notion of Palestinian autonomy in a couple of areas. Anyway, this is what the children look out onto. This was in April 2002, just after the Israelis pulled out and humanitarian relief supplies were able to be brought in. We had to wait over 2 weeks before we were allowed to come in. And there was this large sort of ground zero of about 150 yards by 150 yards where everything had been raised. And this is what those children looked out on. So that establishes the kind of shape that they see to their life. And I want to just back up. On Monday we talked about the context of checkpoints, and you went through a checkpoint to come in here. And I wanted to show you one checkpoint in between Ramallah and Jerusalem at Calandia, which is a refugee camp and also borders the local Jerusalem airport. And this is the checkpoint. When we came to Israel, Palestine in 1998, there were no checkpoints on this road. And shortly after the Intifada began, the checkpoints began to quickly spring up. At first you could drive through, and I think I mentioned that sometimes there would be five lanes of traffic going in one direction. This is a two-lane road. and two going in the other direction. And it was just complete chaos because they have only a few soldiers there to oversee this. Anyway, this is what a checkpoint looks like. We would like to show you a video, but it's very difficult to do videotaping around Israeli checkpoints. So the men would have to come up to the checkpoint. They would often have to lift up their shirts to show that they had no kind of suicide bomb strapped to their chest. And I wanted to show this picture because this was on a day that there was a delegation of people from the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the ELCA, and the bishop, the person that we work closely with, Bishop Aniv Yunan of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, was our leader. And he had secured permission from the military so that we could drive through rather than walk through. You no longer can drive through this checkpoint. You walk, and you walk several hundred yards, 150 yards. So that's what you see those women in the background doing. And so Bishop Maniv had received permission, but as often is the case, that permission doesn't filter down to the soldiers on the ground. And so each time it's an argument, and he has to convince them that we have permission, then they have to call their commanding officer and make sure we do. But it happens every time.
And what this is just a little bit emblematic of is the way that that the church, and he in particular, has had to constantly be engaged with the military presence of the Israelis in the areas that he ministers.
These are the last set of slides, and we'll go through these quickly. Again, I want you to think about context, your own context. And what I want to do is use some work that our oldest son, Nathaniel, did for an art project, where he takes the context of Jerusalem and the area around Jerusalem, which is already surreal enough, and then he stretches it. So here we have a convoy leaving Bethlehem and its neighboring village of Beit Jala. We had just delivered a shipment of food. Bethlehem was occupied by the soldiers, and so it was under curfew. And so we came in a convoy of about 20 vehicles and trucks to deliver food to the Syrian Orthodox Church, the Roman Catholics, and remember the other, and Greek Catholics. And so we were just leaving at Beit Jala. And then suddenly, through Nathaniel's eyes, we are in a kind of Star Wars scene, where the title for this piece is, "These are not the droids we are looking for." This is our neighborhood in Jerusalem. This is just behind our house. There's a shepherd with his flock of sheep. This is taken this spring, and always the rusted out vehicle that's been burnt once or twice by local kids. And I went to take a picture, and then Nathaniel took the same picture, and then we have a different context. Or if you're hiking, this is just a couple, about a mile or so from here, and looking down into that little valley, and suddenly the Dome of the Rock appears. So I want us all to be thinking about the context that we have, that we carry within us, and that shapes our worldview. And we will try to tell you more this afternoon about our context, as well as trying to give you a lot of factoids, a lot of facts quickly, I hope cogently presented, that will help you get a quick overview of the situation in Palestine, Israel today.
Really multimedia today. We're doing a
Okay, what we're going to show you today are transparencies from a book of which I think there's still three copies in the bookstore. A wonderful little primer by Baptist Alex Awad, who is serving with the United Methodist Church in the United States and is deployed as a missionary to his native Palestine, along with his wife Brenda from Kentucky. He's done a wonderful primer. There are three copies left in the bookstore. And I invite you to grab a copy. And at the back of it, there is a CD-ROM disc, which has the entire text of the book, as well as these maps. And so these are the transparencies reprinted with his permission from the book. We're going to give you a quick overview. We're going to try to again think about context, and this time we're going to use maps as our vehicle. And so here you have an image. It's without citation, so I don't know from what source Alex had this map, but it's originally, you know, the Zionist program, dream, vision, began in the 19th century when Herzl, the founder of the World Zionism movement, was convinced that the only way Jews would ever be safe is if they had a state of their own. And so this is one image of a potential Zionist state. They had thought about establishing a state in Uganda or Madagascar and came to the conclusion that the most feasible option was in Palestine, which was the name of this area since Roman times. And then in 1917 began the British mandate to oversee this area and to try to develop a program. There had been promises to the to Jewish groups to establish.
Did we hand out the papers of the, you should hand out, actually, as we go along, this would probably be helpful, What we've done is a little crib sheet based on Gary Berge's book over there. Of a timeline within the 20th century of the major political moves in Israel Palestine, and so as you go along and you notice the dates of these maps, hopefully you'll be able to track it with the wars and whatever might have been going on at about the same time.
And also another book that we recommend to you is not available in the bookstore, Whose Land, Whose Promise. And this looks at the conflict from the perspective of American evangelicals. It looks at the promise to Israel of the land and wants to lift up the state of Israel to scrutiny using not modern political norms or international law primarily, but using the Israelite prophets to judge what is happening as to whether it is just or not. And so it's very helpful if in particular you are an evangelical. So as the British had what was called Mandate Palestine, they had to develop a plan for its development. And on one hand, they had promised the Jews in the Balfour Declaration, a state of their own. In that declaration, there is not a word about the Arabs. You would not know that there were Palestinians in
there
the land.
There are only 25, so there are a couple more there.
And so what is significant, we're going to try to go through these quickly. What is significant is to note that there was a Peel Commission, there was an Arab uprising protesting the moving in of and the purchasing of land and the threat of, from the Palestinian perspective, of a Jewish state. And so there was an English commission set up called the Peel Commission Partition Plan. This was a proposal that they came up with. So essentially, you have here an Arab state, in the yellow, you have a Jewish state, and then you have this nice green area. This was in the era of colonialism, of course. That was reserved for the British and included Jerusalem with access to the Mediterranean. That's 1937. Now look at the date on this next map. which is the UN partition plan. 1947. And of course, what is the major historical reality in that intervening 10-year period? And there you see a tremendous change in the areas that were allotted, again, without any kind of Palestinian participation.
Let me just sort of compare the two here.
What's Jerusalem in that plan?
Where is Jerusalem?
It's what's called a corpus separatum. That's the legal term that the United Nations gave to it. In other words, an international city, a city that was not, did not have its sovereignty determined either by an Arab nation or an Israeli nation.
What you see in the sort of red striped area over here is, what did we decide it was? It's basically what is there now for the what should be the Palestinians. So the 1967 borders.
Yeah, so the striped area is what happened, but the whole red area is what was proposed.
So the in the 1967 war, is that what you said? Is the smaller piece.
Is the
No, in 1948 they got the
whole thing.
Yeah, well they got this area right here. And then this area south of Rafah in the Gaza Strip along the Sinai, the Egyptian border.
So what you see here, what's important here is that the proposed United Nations partition plan compared to what happened after the 1967 war 20 years later is less. Let's see. The West Bank. Yeah, this would be what we presently call the West Bank, the striped area, and then this is Gaza down here.
So this shows the results of the 1948 conflict, and so you can see that Israel
of 1960,
took away the area of that. So this is from 1948 right here, and then there's a large no man's area around parts of the West Bank, and then you can't see it on this map, but also around Jerusalem.
This is a map that depicts all of the villages that have been, the Arab villages that were depopulated in 1948 and 1967. All of those dots were former villages for Palestinians, and they have disappeared.
There's well over 400. Most of these are black dots symbolizing what took place in 1948, and then there are green dots here, and I don't know if elsewhere. I think just around Jerusalem and the West Bank were depopulated.
So that's Israel. I mean, what you're looking at is the yellow area that is Israel.
I mean, so you just think that's just amazing. So you can go for, sometimes on various occasions, members of our congregation, we would have picnics. And we would go to places, wonderful woods that had been Palestinian villages, and you would never know it. There's no sign that says, this was the village of such and such a group of people, families, and during the 1948 war, it was taken over or depopulated.
What does depopulated mean?
People
it means
left.
Okay. Yeah. So what it can mean several. It means that the original inhabitants have left. Why they left is the critical question. In some cases, they left because they had been essentially overtaken by a military battle and forced out. In other cases, they left because they were afraid. In most cases, when they did leave, they thought they would be able to come back in several weeks. There was a line taken by the Israelis that Arab governments in the surrounding countries during the 1948 war had urged the Arabs to leave, and that has been shown to be not true. There was no call by the Arab nations for the Arabs in Palestine to leave.
So where did they go? Yeah. We'll get to that in a little while.
And so this shows the results of the 1967 war, principally the taking of the Golan Heights, a kind of security buffer in northern Israel, between Lebanon and Israel, and of course this was all occupied.
So you see, if you look at your sheets that you have with you there on the 1967, the listing of Israel's strategic goal being toward the east of the West Bank, Golan Heights, Sinai, and Jerusalem. Okay, Sinai is not exactly east, but it is east, yes.
What I want to, I probably should have pointed this out when we were looking at earlier maps, but do you remember the map from the Peel Commission in 1937, where it had a rather small Jewish state and a much larger Arab state? Let me just read a couple of facts from that time. 1937, the Arabs of Palestine owned over 94% of the land, while Jews, including native Palestinian Jews and recent immigrants together, owned less than 6% of the land. Of the roughly 1,400,000 people living in Palestine at the time, almost 400,000, or about 28%, were Jewish. Half the population of the Yellow Zone itself were Arabs. The Peel Commission suggested that 250,000 Palestinians be evacuated from this area, that is from the Yellow area, to make room for a Jewish state. Naturally, the Palestinians that lived in that area thought it was unfair. And so that constituted the major reason for the uprising. And then another commission, just like today, another commission was established to try to resolve this, called the McDonald Commission. And it said that the McDonald Commission said that the Balfour Declaration could not have intended that Palestinians should be converted into a Jewish state against the will of the Arab population of the country. Instead, the white paper declared that Palestine would become independent in 1949 as a unified state, in other words, a binational or bilateral state in which both Arabs and Jews would share in government. And then in the 1947 partition map, also the statistics of relative population sizes is significant. Palestinians in 1947 still accounted for about 65% of the population, did not understand why 35% of the population, which was Jewish, was being granted 54% of the Palestinian land. At this time, Palestinians owned about 87.5% of the total area of Palestine, while Jews owned 6.6% of the total lands. The remaining 5.9% was, quote, state land as classified by the British mandate. Losing so much of their land to a foreign people was not acceptable to the Palestinians.
Might be helpful as we look at this next one to see, again, this other map attached. I'm having trouble. I gotta, you know, it's so backwards, it's hard to do. As those of you know who do this. Okay. So what we're looking at here in the enlarged is this section again.
And I want to lift up once again what Jeff Halper, an academic who teaches at Ben-Gurion University in the Negev in southern Israel. Jeff was the person I mentioned yesterday, or Monday, who was from Minnesota, who is Israeli now. What he talks about is a matrix of control. So you have these settlements, or as most Palestinians prefer to call them, colonies, that are throughout the West Bank. And this is in 1998.
No, it says from 67 to 1998.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, the settlements began in 67. Sharon, the current leader of Israel, was one of the chief architects of the settlement or the colonizing of this area. And it has military purposes as well. But Jeff talks about the matrix of control. That is, colonies, for the most part, are carefully located with respect to water resources. Roads are of course, needed. Once you have these settlements, you need to have roads, and you have what are called bypass roads. And as one Israeli commentator put it, that if the Palestinians are good children, they can use those bypass roads. But if they are not, if they're bad, they won't be allowed to use them. And that's what has happened. That's why, as I mentioned on Monday, it can be almost impossible if you have this wedding, let's say, in Jenin now, and your son in Jenin is marrying a daughter in Hebron. It can be almost impossible to get there, to secure permission, and to go through all the checkpoints that you would have to go through. But this matrix of control is Jeff's primary thesis, is that like a prison, you can control the vast area of a prison with relatively a few control nodules throughout the area.
So and every one of these little colored dots is a settlement, an Israeli settlement that has been placed in the West Bank since 1967. And most of them, many of them, at least those that are on this map, are built up pretty well established places by this time, and are often chosen to be lived in by settlers, is people who come to Israel, sometimes ideologically wanting to reclaim the land for a theological or ideological reason, but also they receive great economic benefit from the government if they live in these settlements. You can live at a much higher standard of living in a settlement than in other places. You get subsidies.
So is the only places that Israelis live that are called settlements are within the trip with the Palestinian Authority?
Yes.
Okay. And how? What's
well,
the
settlement is a Hebrew. It's a Hebrew word as well, and so they'll talk about settlements in Israel proper as well. And so that's one reason why Palestinians prefer to use the word colonies.
Okay.
Well, except I think that when you hear about the settlements as being the problem in terms of the peace process, we're talking about this.
And many, so how many settlers are there? There's somewhere around 400,000. About 200,000 live in the area surrounding Jerusalem. And for most of those, from everything that I've read, and again, thinking about context and what I mentioned at the beginning, what do you see out of your bedroom window when you arise in the morning? We see East Jerusalem. We see the old city. And that has been, for 5 years, that was our primary context. And so I think we know a lot about Israel from reading, but we don't have it as a primary context. But what I've read, most Israelis do not have any sense of what a settlement is. And those settlers or colonists who live around Jerusalem, for instance, in a community called Maale Adumim, which is to the east of Jerusalem, have stunning views of the Judean wilderness all the way over to Jordan. They probably understand themselves as living in a suburb. That's really the way that they have a, just like many of us, we live in the suburbs, we drive to work in the primary city that is connected to the suburbs.
I have another question. How far, distance-wise, is it from Janine down to Hebron? I mean, what kind of space are you talking about?
Well, we're talking about a very small space, smaller than the state of Maryland. It wouldn't take very, if you had a four-lane road, it would not take very long to drive. A
couple of hours.
But I'll tell you a story. Susan says not to get lost in anecdote, but I'll try not to. I was with a group of people that came to the Seville Center of Liberation Theology. Seville means a spring in Arabic. And there was an international conference in April of this year. And part of our plan for attending the conference was to take them to Galilee for on a kind of pilgrimage, but also especially to follow the wall. We'll be talking about the wall of separation later. But we went and we visited Janine, and we were outside of Janine. And then in the evening, we were at a small village, and we had to drive to Galilee, which is up here further. And to do that, it took us several hours to figure out a way to get out of here and to cross over because so many roads had been blocked. And these were Palestinians that they could, you know, they asked every oncoming car, you know, what is the best way to get out, to go to Nazareth? And it took hours and hours and hours. Go ahead.
This is a map of the Oslo Agreement arrangement, and these different areas, these pink puddles in the West Bank are the areas that were to be under Palestinian Authority control. You see, they aren't connected. They are here, there, everywhere. And then you have Gaza also under Palestinian control.
And so what the fear is that when Sharon talks about Palestinian state, what he's really talking about are what some Palestinians call Swiss cheese nation, or Bantustans, which in the South African context did not result in peace, where essentially Israel controls everything around these Palestinian areas.
To prevent a sense of being a nation?
Yeah. To make it impossible to be a viable nation. That's one of the things we will talk about, whether there's any kind of viability to a two-state solution.
This is basically the same map from 2000, and here you see one big settlement that's being developed around Hebron.
Yeah, I should mention that around Jerusalem, Mali Benin is, let's see, it's not marked.
It's up here,
it's right here, it's in blue right there, is the size of Tel Aviv,
so
the eventual size.
The pink areas still here are proposed Palestinian rule areas.
Right.
And the green, those are settlements?
The green? Those are settlements. Mm-hmm. The blue, or whatever that color is.
So outside of this area where it says Israel, are there people living there?
Uh-huh. There are Israelis and Israeli Arabs. Arabs who have Israeli citizenship within what is known as Israel proper. That area.
Is that area disputed? I mean, the Palestinians, what are they demanding?
Well, it depends which Palestinians you talk with.
Yeah. No, the official.
Are you talking about in terms of the...
No.
Pre-1948 or?
No, I'm talking about, I mean, they're not accepting the Swiss
cheese. That's right, that there's no viability
for that kind of state.
There are groups, there are Palestinians, primarily Muslims, who, they're a small percentage who say, we accept no Israeli state whatsoever. And that, of course, is the great fear of Israelis, that in fact, Palestinians will not ever allow them to have a state of their own. That is a small, small percentage. The vast majority from polling data that Palestinians have conducted show that Palestinians are quite willing to accept a state. We'll talk, that would comprise only 22% of historical Palestine, 22%.
I think we're going to need to move on quickly, but this is just a little bit of an answer to the question earlier about where they went, the refugees, and this is, as you can see, it's include Gaza and the West Bank together. So, you have 35% of the Palestinians in the whole world live there. The rest live elsewhere.
And if you, and then if you include Israel, then you have about 48%. So a little less than half of the Palestinians in the world live in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. And then a very large percentage, 31%, fled to Jordan. In fact, they constitute about 65% of the population of Jordan. Then another large group went to Syria and Lebanon.
Okay. Any more? The next thing I think is the...
We have the thesis.
Yes. I just so that you sort of know what we're presenting during the time we're here, we thought we'd write them all for you. Basically, the first thesis, that an act of grave injustice was done politically to the Palestinian people by the countries of the world through the United Nations in the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. What was restorative justice for the decimated and dispersed Jewish people was a catastrophe, al-Nakba in Arabic, for the resident Palestinians who had not been the perpetrators of the Holocaust. The second thesis is, for those who care about the future of the State of Israel, a just peace can be the only way forward. Armed security alone will fail, and Israel will never be free of terrorism. Israel must be a good and valued neighbor if it is to be secure. And the contracting and constricting of the space and the people out of these either security concerns or expansionist concerns are not seen as being very neighborly. And then again, these what most Palestinians see as necessary for peace, and this certainly from our conversations is what seems to be the case. First, that Israel return to its 1967 borders with a shared Jerusalem. But Jerusalem is the capital of both Israel and Palestine.
Could you put up the map that has that scenario?
That had what?
That scenario, the number one. The 67 borders.
Okay, 67 borders. That was...
That's what you're suggesting.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's not what we are suggesting. It's what I think most Palestinians.
If that were to happen, and the settlements, then the assumption would be that the Israeli settlements within the West Bank, either the people would agree to live, you know, with the Palestinian government, or they would leave, and Palestinians would live there.
And in 2000, there was very close agreement on this, that talks, that was the so-called Taba talks, Taba in Egypt and Sinai, between Israel and the Palestinians. Very close agreement on this with the exchange of certain areas. So for instance, if you had a Jewish settlement in Jerusalem that was part of East Jerusalem, there would be a trade of land for that, so that that part would come under Israeli sovereignty. Or perhaps most especially in the Old City, which belonged until 1967 to Jordan, that the Jewish quarter would be under Israeli sovereignty. So they were prepared to make all sorts of accommodations along those lines. of simple trades.
So the and then the return of refugees is a huge issue. To ask that they be allowed, that they have a right to return according to international law, and that if they don't return, then compensation be given to them.
So now, are we talking about refugees in Jordan and these other places? We're not.
All those villages
and their
you
descendants.
Saw.
And their descendants.
Yeah. So, but we are talking about land that's not under dispute anymore.
We're talking about land that is in Israel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Most of yeah.
And but this is still such
or
a
settled, or places that have been taken by settlers.
This is a very, very sensitive topic. So the article that we cite by James Bennett, just from this week, had to do with the release of this polling data, and there was a small riot where they threatened this man's life. And I assume that they came directly from the refugee camp, one of the refugee camps in Ramallah, or around Ramallah, to protest this, because it's so sensitive. If you saw on Monday the video that we showed of the dancing with the keys that belong to their houses. We had, before we came to Jerusalem, we lived in Vienna. We were pastors at an international church there. And we had many United Nations staff who were members of our congregation because of the United Nations headquarters in Vienna. And one of our members was from was Palestinian. They had the key to their house in Haifa, in their apartment in Vienna. And it pained them that they knew they would never be able to go back to that house. Or there was a wonderful man, there was a group called the Ecumenical Friends in Jerusalem, in the Old City, mostly clergy and priests. And because of ecumenical relations, it's very difficult to get the Greek Orthodox to be in these sorts of associations. So a sort of honorary Greek Orthodox was a dentist named Dr. Khalil. And he, a very well-known Christian Palestinian. And he stood up, he's given to long-winded talks. I see the time out. But one of the things that he said that was really struck me, because it was so short. He stood up at a gathering and he said, "The thing that pains me the most in all my years is my realization that I will die a refugee." That pains him more than anything else.
And the third thing here is that the acknowledgement by Israel that a great wrong has been done to the Palestinian people as a byproduct of the creation of the State of Israel. This is certainly coming back to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, in the sense that we can't move forward if we don't really acknowledge that something wrong has happened, and to be clear about that. So those are things that we'd like you to go away with. So now we have the video.
I have a question. What was the makeup of your congregation?
In Jerusalem?
Yeah.
It was virtually all internationals. There were several Palestinian and Armenian families that were members, mostly through circuitous routes, or they had married an international, or they weren't comfortable in their church of origin, so to speak. Mostly internationals. Most of whom worked with NGOs, non-governmental organizations, or worked for various governments on the diplomatic level. And before 2000, before the beginning of the Intifada, there were many students. We always had groups of Lutheran students coming through, either for a month or longer. And there were always students that were in Jerusalem for the year, as well as scholars. After the Intifada began, within 6 months to a year afterwards, the students tended to disappear, as well as the volunteers, who were usually, but not always, a student age. And the people that remained were people that worked with governments or NGOs.
We're going to move to the roadmap now more specifically, and this is a, we'd like to show you a video that will...
Bill, could you turn on that, at the top of that machine, there is a button that you just push down.
On top of this machine here?
This machine?
Yeah.
On the top of it.
On the top of it in the rear, there.
And that will come on in just a moment.
And this is a part of a series on the roadmap that was done by a British correspondent, television correspondent, for Sky News, which is a British news channel. And we knew him in Jerusalem.
So we're going to show, he did various components of the roadmap. Today it's the wall. And then we're going to come back and talk about that roadmap.
This was done in mid-May of this year. Sound.
Palestinian suicide attack and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is taking his own preventative measure. It's called a separation wall, a 6-meter-high security fence topped with guard towers and barbed wire. It's under construction. It's costing Israel £1 million a mile to build. Eventually, the separation wall will run along the whole of the West Bank border with Israel. So far, though, this line has got to this area, at Qalqilya, just south of the Palestinian town, from where Sky's Middle East correspondent Andrew Wilson joins us live.
This is the house that was built by Nabil Shreve in 1998. He had a supermarket business in the center of Qalqilya, and it was doing well. He built it beautifully. But what he liked most about it was that it had its fine views over the hills of Israel, and before that, the lemon groves and orange orchards that his neighbors and farmers from around Qalqilya were growing. Now all that has changed. What he has now is a view of Israel's separation barrier. And as you can see, it's enormous. My colleague David Bowden has been south of Qalqilya to see how the construction work on the wall has been progressing.
Snaking through an already divided land, the construction work goes on apace to build the physical barrier that will seal off Palestinian territory from Israel. The separation wall, as it's known, is Israel's latest attempt at securing its people from the suicide bombers crossing from the West Bank. But Palestinians see it as yet another hostile act from their fleeing, more powerful neighbour. Sadek Mustafa is a Palestinian fruit farmer whose land at Falamia is being cut in half by the wall. He's already lost more than 100 citrus trees to the diggers, which are biting into his earth. And he fears that when the wall is finished, his livelihood will be finished too.
How can we live? We cannot live off of this. Because we cannot work in Israel, and there isn't any money to live.
The Israelis are acutely aware of the controversy surrounding the building of the barrier, and security guards attempted to stop us filming it.
What's wrong? Why
are you stopping us? As the armored car roared off along the line of the wall, Sadek tried to cross to his fruit trees and workers on the other side. But again, security staff blocked him.
Can this man go to his fields?
Good. Why not?
That road.
Whose road? But these are his orange trees. He has workers in there. Why can he not go in?
One of the major grievances the Palestinians have about this barrier is that whilst it's designed to protect Israelis, it's being built on Palestinian land. And in some places, it's taking great swathes of Palestinian territory and effectively annexing it to Israel.
Opposite Falamia, on the Israeli side of the barrier, is the upmarket residential area of Kuhab Yaya. Judith Johnson lives here with her partner, Philip Brooks. Neither of them want the wall, but both believe it's a necessary evil if Israelis are to feel safe in their own land.
And I think about them, and I'm thinking about
My life is from the security side, but I can not worry about family going to cafes, going to business things in the cities, and worry about whether they're going to be coming home.
The situation has got to the point where security is the major issue. And basically, you just can't live in a house not put a fence up. You just let anybody perhaps be passing on the street, break in and attack your family or children or whatever. That's just a natural sort of progression.
When it's finished, the barrier will stretch the entire length of the western edge of the West Bank, an unofficial, tangible border between Israel and the Palestinians.
The earth in the West Bank is at its finest in Qalqilya. This is where 40% from Jenin, Tilkarm and this city, 40% of the West Bank's agricultural produce comes from. It's an agricultural problem having the fence here. It's an economic problem, therefore, having the fence here. And it's also, of course, in terms of the roadmap, a political issue as well. Joining me now is Diana Bhutto, thanks very much, PLO legal advisor. What kind of effect is this having on your chances to get here?
Very much like the settlements, Israel has already begun to create facts on the ground, facts that will be very difficult to remove. The wall itself is already stretching along 7 kilometers and well into Palestinian territory. Although not in this area, but in other areas, it stretches about 6 kilometers into the West Bank, and we project that it's going to end up resulting in the de facto annexation of 50% of the West Bank. But Israelis themselves don't know where the wall is going. If the wall is not going on the international border, it's not going on the Green Line. And so for many Israelis, they aren't quite aware of where the wall is going. They have no idea that it's going to have a devastating impact on the Palestinians, and more importantly, a devastating impact on peace.
Someone else you want to meet now, a man I only met a couple of minutes ago. We came across him when we first set up here. A man who's been trying to scratch the living out of what was left of his earth. Bear in mind that this 30-meter stretch here was, up until recently, filled with trees full of fruit. Now it's barren. This is Omar Albaz. Omar, you're growing okra here, aren't you?
No, okra is something else. Sometimes, like, you know, we have too much trees, but when they make a storm, they damage everything. They stole more than half of our land.
And how much land was left on the other side of the wall?
On the other side of the wall, we had
About 2 acres,
yeah.
Yes. Indeed. And what effect will it have on you now and your family with this wall being there?
We live here as in prison because of this wall, and we have all this as in prison. This is incredible. And because we have more than half our land was lost.
Well, as you can see, it is indeed a dilemma, and it must at some point, even though it's not linked into the roadmap, become an enormous issue for Israeli Palestinians and their future. George Bush said last year that he was behind the idea of a viable Palestinian state. Well, the roadmap may produce a Palestinian state, but it's questionable at this stage whether it will ever be viable.
Okay, the roadmap. I guess the main thing with this would be to just read through it with you and see if you understand what these terms, you know, what, or have questions about what they mean when they say things here. The goals, first one, to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through a negotiated settlement, leading to a final and comprehensive settlement of the Israel-Palestinian conflict by 2005.
Now, there are various phases in this process, and it's already well behind schedule.
The second goal is to end the occupation.
And this is very important because this is the first time that the word occupation has been mentioned. Israel submitted over 100, quote, corrections to the roadmap that they wanted the quartet of nations to address and to actually change the wording. They wanted to use the word disputed land.
And the third, to see the emergence of an independent, democratic Palestinian state side by side in peace and security with Israel and its other neighbors. Clearly then this two-state solution is being pursued rather than a bilateral single sort of thing. And it's interesting, it says the peace and security with Israel, I think also applies to peace and security for the Palestinian state too. And fourth, to address Israel's strategic goals of security and regional integration.
Regional integration?
Regional integration means wanting to be able to be seen as a permanent part of the Middle East map.
Yeah, I think one of the great questions that Israel has, it's an internal question, is are we European or are we Middle Eastern? Keep in mind that Israel is essentially has two large groups of people, Ashkenazi Jews from Europe and Sephardic Jews from the Middle East. And those two groups have come together in Israel. And the Arab neighbors have not admitted Israel to the Middle Eastern club, so to speak. And the Europeans, recognizing the European connection to the creation of the State of Israel, have. And so Israel is a member of a number of European organizations. Most recently, they have begun exploratory steps on whether or not they can join the European Union. And so are they European or are they Middle Eastern? And that's a big question.
And also, I mean, to recognize the fact that, I mean, there have been Arab statements about, you know, that we're going to push you into the sea. I mean, we hear this over and over again as Israel remembers this, okay? So to be there permanently and real.
Yeah, and this is why, just jumping down quickly to the mechanisms, why the Arab initiative is so important. One of the quote corrections that Israel wanted was to remove the statement from the roadmap, even though this statement says explicitly that the Arab countries will recognize Israel within the 1967 borders.
And then how to get to that, these mechanisms that are being put forward. First, using these principles that have already been established, and it's very interesting, I think, that at least these you hear about Resolution 242. It says goals and process based on terms of reference and principle of land for peace. These various UN resolutions, two of them at least are here. And they, one is basically an affirmation of the second is basically an affirmation of the first one. But you'll hear Resolution 242 and 338 referred to constantly in the discussion. The establishing, this is from 1967, you notice, 242 is from 1967, and is calling for the withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from the territories occupied in the recent conflict, termination of all claims or states of belligerency and respect for and acknowledgement of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence of every state in the area and their rights to live in peace within secured and recognized boundaries, and is asking for a just settlement of the refugee problem. And again, 338 and after the 73 war, calling upon them to implement that resolution. So it's just referring back, and we've been at this a long time. It's time to really get serious about it.
And maybe time for questions now.
Yeah.
What happens to the city of Jerusalem under this plan? Is it carved out or not?
That it remains to be seen. It's subject to negotiation. Yeah. And there have been hundreds, really hundreds of studies, proposals between Israelis and Palestinians and separately to try to come to a resolution that will meet the needs of most of the people of that city.
But as far as we know, the roadmap itself doesn't have a specific plan about Jerusalem. That's one of the weaknesses of it, as it doesn't have a specific plan for the refugees, which is another weakness.
Mm-hmm. There's some thought that the idea would be that it is a kind of incentive. If you had the plan sort of in place with the end game already delineated, so that would be an incentive for moderate Palestinians, moderate Israelis to sign up to the road plan rather than to subject it to the veto power of extremists. So if you have as your first goal stop the violence, which sounds like a sensible goal, indeed is a sensible goal, but if that is your first goal and you can't take a step further without achieving cessation of violence, then you're subject to any extremist on the right or the left who can blow up a bomb.
And that's been the...
And so if you know from the beginning, this is what's going to happen. Refugees are going to be either given compensation, and a limited number of refugees will be allowed back into the pre-1967 borders of Israel. Go ahead.
I read that article. I'm a little confused. This is a roadmap here, but the slide before referenced that article in the New York Times. I read that also in the library just a couple days ago. And it said like 15% of the people only want to return, which really surprised me. And that's why his office was attacked. That previous slide, are those your thoughts, your opinions and
on the slide?
And those are ours.
Those were us.
Those are yours.
I think they reflect.
But that second point that referred to the article, it seems that the first sentence contradicts the second sentence. In recognition of the right of return for the refugees.
Yeah, I think what's being argued there is that under international law, this is very clear, refugees have the right of return. Palestinians say, why should Jews who, in theory, were forced out of Israel in 2,000 years ago by the Romans, they are given immediate citizenship and allowed the right of return. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't our citizens be allowed that same right when it's within historical memory of the current generation?
I agree.
But
doesn't that surprise you that this polling expert, it was only 15% that wanted to return?
I was shocked. I mean, some people have sort of established their new homes. They think that they will be unwelcomed by Israelis, or as the article pointed out, their homes may not exist.
I think they're realists. They're trying to just be realistic about what their real future is likely to be.
They don't have too much faith in the
in how it's going to be if they come back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's also, there's a whole lot of refugees that are now that weren't there to begin with. They're the children and the descendants of the people who left
mm-hmm.
in
right.
48. I mean, right. They don't have any experience
have the
of the
connection.
Homeland. They don't have the same connection.
Yeah.
But when you talk to Palestinians who are the children of the original refugees, it is not unusual at all when you say, where are you from? And they'll say Haifa, even though they've never been to Haifa. I could have shown, maybe I'll show it later, I could have shown a slide of a colleague of ours at Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem, Sandra Olwine, who was sent to Jerusalem by the United Methodists. She, we had a Palm Sunday, every year there's this wonderful march, parade, pilgrimage for Palm Sunday. And as we were walking with our congregation and others, both Palestinians and internationals, I saw Sandra and I said, Sandra, what are you doing here? I mean, it wasn't surprising that she was there. She's an international. But she had 50 people from her congregation. She had gotten a bus and the Israelis allowed them to go out of the Bethlehem that often is very difficult, even for explicitly religious purposes. And it was wonderful to walk with this group because many of the children, most of the children, had never been to Jerusalem before. And they lived just a few miles away. And for her to point out, where the various things, this is Gethsemane, you know, this is the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, and so on.
We're really coming to the end of our hour. We're past it a bit, but I think that maybe one of the most significant things about the roadmap is that we don't want to be dismissive at all of the possibilities here in terms of getting, you know, haven't been getting anywhere. So if this can get us somewhere, great. What it does seem to be more clear about is to have a monitoring, an outside monitoring that is broader. And the U.S. is going to be very key in this and how it tries to keep both parties to its agreements will be very, very important.
Do the Palestinian Christians have any thought that the Israelis have any right at all to be there? Do they feel like they really, biblically?
I think that's a very interesting question because of the way Palestinian Christians read the Old Testament. To read the Bible, to read in, say, Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Vienna, places where we serve, about the promise of the land, you can almost read that without tripping over it. And you think, well, that's wonderful. And then to come to Jerusalem in one of our first Sundays to have readings about the land as the first lesson. And you really, again, it's the context. And so for Palestinian Christians, it's been the Old Testament is a very difficult book indeed. And many of them use the Latin Missal, the lectionary readings, which often will omit an Old Testament reading. Anyway, so it's not just that they're Marcionite, they're using an older lectionary system. But how they read the Old Testament, you know, we don't want to rob them of the Old Testament.
So the answer is no. They don't see that they have any right whatsoever to come.
No, that would be much too extreme. Yeah. No, much too extreme.
I think virtually everybody we've ever talked to realizes that Israel is here to stay.
Is the wall, as it works out, is that the actual roadmap?
No.
Now that's interesting.
If this wall's being built, I mean, is that the roadmap? Then my next question is paying for the wall.
Well, we contribute between $13 and $16 million a day to Israel, over $3 billion a year, and the Israelis would like for that amount to increase. The wall is a kind of de facto border, and that alarms some right-wing Israelis because that cedes land to the Palestinians. Yeah. But in many cases, that wall, as it was mentioned in the video clip, is being built entirely on Palestinian land. And in some cases, as the woman mentioned, 6 kilometers inside the West Bank. And that connects, again, this matrix of control. It connects up with Israeli colonies, and provides a kind of defensive shield around them. I should mention that when I say bypass roads, I want you to understand, you saw those little dots, and you think, well, maybe they're not so many, or they're not so big, they're just, you know, a few caravans, or, you know, 20, 30, 100 houses. That when you have a bypass road, you have a security clearance on either side of 200 yards or 200 meters. That's a tremendous. So any Palestinian house along that bypass road can be demolished. 10,000 Palestinian dwellings have been demolished since 1967 in the West Bank. And if you, I have on my computer various Geneva conventions concerning how people in occupied territories are to be treated. And one of the strict prohibitions is against collective punishment, which is what happens time and time again. But can I say one more thing? And then I'll be glad to talk with anyone for however long you would like to talk. Lest you hear our remarks as being anti-Israeli, I think I would like to characterize them as pro-Palestinian. But for those people, and I would characterize especially evangelical, or what sometimes are called Zionist Christians, who see a kind of fulfillment of God's prophecy in the establishment of the state of Israel, that for those who love Israel, this is the time to come to its defense, not by telling Congress that if you allow Israel to surrender any of its land, it's an obscenity, but to say Israel has, it's a time for tough love, as many people have pointed out, that Israel has got to make peace through a just mechanism to establish. Otherwise, it will never have peace. And we know, just in our own lifetimes, nation states can disappear. We spent a lot of time in East Germany in the 1980s, and we never thought that East Germany would just disappear. That's a different case, but it's not on the map anymore.
Certainly didn't think the Soviet Union was going to disappear.
Tomorrow we're going to talk.
If people have 2 more minutes to stay. Yeah. We have a wonderful little bit on this video. Anyone who would like to stay and watch, it's 2 minutes of the Bishop of Exeter.
Those who would like to leave should leave.
Those who leave want to leave can.
Go ahead and turn the video machine back on.